My name is Tammy Brookerhoff, and I'm the tourism director here in Herman, Missouri.
So the pioneers, they were primarily German immigrants, right?
Yeah. 1836, 1837 is when they came here from the Philadelphia Settlement Society. Mm-hmm. Came to Herman because they saw the rolling hills, and they thought it would be a wonderful place to grow grapes and support their families. If you look at some early pictures of Herman, you'll see that where houses are today is where grape, where they were planted. Mm-hmm. And that's how we started the grape and wine industry here in the Herman area.
And that ethnic roots is very much intact and unchanged here in Herman today.
You see so much of our German heritage, and there's so many of the buildings that have been preserved. We have generations that are still running businesses in that wonderful German culture.
What a beautiful architecture town.
Yes, we have so much red brick. The beautiful courthouse up on the bluff that greets you as you come across the Missouri River, and then the church up on the hill to the right, it gives you that amazing wow factor when you come into our town, something that a lot of towns don't have.
And how older, on average, the older houses?
Most of them are from the early 1900s, probably. Mm-hmm. Do you have some friends now that are renovating a home that is one of the oldest homes in Herman, so late 1800s.
How many people live here?
About 2,300, depending on who you ask.
And everybody pretty much knows each other.
Pretty much. Yeah. We have a lot of young families that are moving into our community.
Cool.
They're entrepreneurs. They see the beauty of our town. They see the cleanliness, and their schools are fantastic. I think that's the heart of our community, that we're all still very much tied to the land, and we welcome entrepreneurship.
And this could be a Great American Railway journey destination.
Absolutely.
You've got Amtrak comes right through town and stops here, right?
Yes, we have 4 stops a day. Actually, I just came from our Amtrak station. Mm-hmm. The train came from St. Louis and is heading to Kansas City. So we have 4 stops a day.
That's cool.
Two from Kansas City and 2 from St. Louis.
So do you ever just take the train and leave the car at home?
You have to. And we really have been trying to market the Amtrak a lot more these last few years.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just one of those underutilized services that a lot of our locals think, oh, it's for the visitors to town and for them as well. So we've had so many grandparents and parents taking their kids and grandkids on wonderful excursions, just day trips or weekend trips or even just an afternoon trip. It's such a wonderful asset that we have in our state, so we're really fortunate. It's amazing who comes off the train and what their stories are. We've had people that, you know, have been riding from one side of the country to the other, that it's just so interesting to hear their stories. Our website is visitherman.com, and it's 2 N's.
Yeah.
We also have our social media, Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest.
Quick word picture of your museum.
The Deutschheim State Historic Site is up at 2nd and Market Street. There's several homes there that you can tour. The piano history, there was pianos built here in Herman in those homes. We also have at the Deutschheim State Historic Site is an old printing press. That printing press printed the Hermaner Volkenblatt. It was printed in German. The people that owned it were actually abolitionists, and Herman being anti-slavery. So we have lots of people that come here to learn more about that history. And then we have some of the oldest grapevines that are planted in the town.
In the state.
They were planted by George Hoosman when he was here before he went to Napa Valley and started Napa Valley. So we also have the Historic Herman Museum, which is at 4th and Schiller Street. It is a 2-story museum. You'll go back in time there. It has a clock tower and a bell tower. It was the school here in town at one time. It used to be called the German School Museum, but now that they've got so much more history in there than just German school history, it is now called the Historic Herman Museum.
And then you guys have a little trolley tours?
It's a private business. It's the Herman Trolley. You can find him, HermanTrolley2022.com, owned by Aaron Kratz, and he'll meet people at the train, take them around to several wineries, the brewery, the distilleries, take them to the museums, take you to your lodging establishment.
For the people coming in on train, that would be perfect way to get around. You don't have to rent a car.
So come into town on the train. The trolley's right there to pick you up, take you to your lodging establishment, and then take you around and show you our beautiful town.
One more thing that you're most proud of.
The Katy Trail is really a wonderful asset that we have here. Mm-hmm. It's just north of the river here. It goes from Kansas City to St. Louis. So people come from all over the world to bicycle the Katy Trail from one end to the other. And what we also try to promote with that is you can bike Katy, ride Amtrak. So they'll get on the train in Herman with their bicycles, ride the train to Sedalia, and then ride their bicycles back from Sedalia to Herman. And that's about a two-day ride, one night, overnight. Works really great. My name is Tammy Bruckerhoff, and I'm the tourism director here in Herman.
Awesome.
Come see us.
I want to stay.
Yeah, you should. Come back and visit for a longer visit.
Yeah.
My name is Bruce Cox. I am the mayor of Herman, Missouri. I moved here in 1982.
What brought you here?
Well, back at that day, I used to publish a little antique newspaper, and I used to come to Herman hitting all the antique stores that were here. And I would come every month and got to know people. And after about 2 years, I told the wife if I ever wanted to move, I think I found a place that I would like to go. I
Right.
found this great community.
What most attracted you?
The people and just the historic significance of the buildings. It was just a beautiful place to be, and so I thought that's where I'd like to go. And
this is my first day here, and I'm still
right.
awestruck by the historic architecture going way back.
Herman was a big riverboat town back in the day, even during the Civil War. The courthouse overlooks the river, and the Confederates were apparently across the river, and we have one cannon in town. And what they did is they put the cannon by the courthouse and shot a volley across the river, hurry up, and moved it to the Calmar's Bluff, which is the big bluff.
Uh-huh.
To the east, and shot another valley and across the river. The Confederates never attacked because they thought we were fortified.
They thought you had three or four cannons.
Right. So, you know.
I love it.
Herman today, we are a blessed community. We rely on our great tourism industry. We have what we call a tourism tax from people that stay at the guest mm-hmm. houses and B&Bs.
This is a relatively safe place to go. It's really an outdoor environment, isn't it?
Yeah, we got the wineries. Everybody has outdoor seating, usually the restaurants. Mm-hmm. On the weekends, we have a tremendous amount of people that come to town. We have 160 guest houses and B&Bs, which is wonderful.
That would include VRBO and...
Yes.
Uh-huh. What's your biggest frustration?
My biggest frustration?
Yes, mayor, yeah. Something you... wanted to get done or tried to get done and haven't.
I guess our biggest challenge right now is because of the guest house situation, mm-hmm. more affordable housing for people.
Yeah.
And we've actually got a couple projects on the drawing boards. So there's a whole lot of projects that's on the drawing board. Mm-hmm. If they all come together.
To learn more about your town, do you have a website?
If anybody wants to come visit Herman, they need to go to visitherman.com.
There
that
you
has
go.
All the schedules and everything, the activities that are coming up, because there's always something going on in Herman, not every weekend, but almost every weekend, from car shows to, you know, we got the Oktoberfest, the big craft show, and then we have Christmas.
And you're about an hour from St. Louis?
Depending on which way, you can come out 70 or you can come out 44 to mm-hmm. Highway 100 in an hour to hour and 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
On a good day. And my name is Bruce Cox, Mayor of Herman, Missouri.
Thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you.
My name is Susan Nichols, and we are at the Herman Farm Museum in Herman, Missouri, 526 East 1st Street.
And you work here?
I do. I've been here since 2016.
And what do you do here?
I am a tour guide. Mm-hmm. So we do tractor-driven tram tours through the farm.
Oh, cool.
And
so I drive my own tractor.
Well, we have somebody who does that.
Right.
I ride along on the tram, and I tell people about the history of Herman, the history of the farm, and we stop at several different places.
Cool. Tell us about the history of Herman Farm.
So Herman Farm, actually, the Dierbergs bought the property in the early 2000s. The Dierbergs had a vision, wanted something that they could keep the history alive for the city of Herman and for the people that had lived on this location here on this farm.
So what was here when they came?
When they came, it was the Kallmeyer family farmed here. They raised cattle. They also raised mules and draft horses during World War I and II, and
oh,
they
wow.
shipped them overseas and were used in the war effort. But before that, and actually what we really focus on, is the legacy of George Hussman, who is considered the father of viticulture in Missouri.
Isn't that amazing?
It is.
And he was right here?
He came in the 1840s
mm-hmm.
from Germany with his family. Mm-hmm. He wrote about seeing the steamboats down on Wharf Street and how crazy it was and all the different people that were there. But he grew up here then. He mm-hmm. was a young man. He grew up in this area. He started a nursery where the Herman Farm is. It was called the Herman Nursery. He had over 250 varieties of fruit trees and plants and bushes and 50 varieties of grapes that he grew here.
Wow. How did he keep it all going? He must have hired help.
He did. He had a partner in his nursery business, Charles Manwaring, who was also a captain in the Union Army. But Mr. Manwaring helped him with the business, and we actually have one of the catalogs from the 1850s that shows all the different varieties of fruit trees and things that he grew here.
Wow. And so they would wrap them up in burlap and ship them out?
Yes, they would ship them. They also sold them from here. Mm-hmm. He would ship them using steamboat for the most part. And then, of course, in 1855, the railroad came through on this side of the river. So then he could start shipping things using the railroad, which was probably much more convenient.
And people today don't know or they forget that in that time, this was the frontier of the Wild West of America.
Yes.
Hard
yes,
to
it
believe.
Was. Huh? Yes, it was. And and those Germans that came here, that first came here, they really wanted some place that they could celebrate their German traditions.
Mm-hmm. And have opportunity.
Yes, exactly.
Because we talked earlier about in Germany, there was progenitor. Only the oldest son got anything, and the rest were, out of luck.
Right. And the society, the German Settlement Society of Philadelphia that started Herman, they would sell, you know, lots or 40-acre areas that they could do their farming on. You know, of course, now general farming wasn't great here because of the hills. Right. So they did do a lot of grapes, and that's what they, you know, you've heard about that all around this area.
Yeah, that's
that there
crazy.
Were lots of wineries and lots of grape growers.
So really, in many respects, this was the birthplace of American viticulture.
Yes, it was. And George Hussman is also attributed with helping save the grape industry or the wine industry in France and Europe in the 1860s because of the phylloxera outbreak. And phylloxera being a louse that attaches itself to the rootstock of grapes. He and some other gentlemen knew that the rootstock here was immune to that louse. Mm-hmm. And so they shipped, I think it was like 10 million rootstock to France.
So they literally saved the French viticulture industry. Mm-hmm. That's a call. Going forward, this community of Herman has retained and cherished their German heritage in all different cultural manifestations to this day, even though there was some blowback, World War I, World War II.
Yes. It wasn't until more recent years that they actually stopped teaching German in the high school as a second language. It was very important. It's always been very important to keep that German tradition alive here.
Mm. And families would speak German sometimes in the household.
They would, yes. And my mother did. My grandmothers did, yes.
So today you must have some great festivals and things that celebrate that heritage.
We do. We have one in May. I think it's the third weekend in May that's called the May Fest or May Festival. And then, of course, the whole month of October is Oktoberfest. So there's lots of beer drinking and wine and distilleries and, you know, things like that going on at that time.
And do you have breweries here?
We have, I know of one, I believe there might be two breweries here. Actually, our master distiller for the distillery here is also our brewmaster at the Tin Mill Brewery. And so he's been in that business for ever since out of college. So. Oh.
So what are some of the number one, two, and three tourist visitor draws to Herman and the surrounding area?
Well, I think that the Herman Farm is one of the top draws, you know, for every age. Little children on up to older people would love the Herman Farm. We have a lot of other museums here, as well as many shops, quaint little shops, and we have, you know, all the beer and the wine and the distilleries here as well.
And somebody base camped in St. Louis, Missouri, this could be a day trip.
Oh, easily, yes. Yeah. And we get lots of those at the farm. Lots of people, and lots of people that come out, stay at, you know, one of the bed and breakfasts we have. I want to say 300 some bed and breakfast rooms in the city of Herman. So it's a big industry here.
That's really cool. It's growing.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it is.
A healthy economy.
It is.
To learn more about your world.
HermanFarm.org. Herman with two N's. Farm.org.
So it's a nonprofit.
It is. We are operated by the Dierbergh Educational Foundation. So we are trying to keep the history of the 1850s and 1860s alive. Mm-hmm. And you can find out more information at that website, HermanFarm.org. And my name is Susan.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right. I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Missouri. We'll see you there.
My name is Parker Pukta. I'm seventh generation at Adam Pukta Winery. I'm the vice president and CEO.
Wow. Going back in time, your family, that's seven generations.
Yeah, so we're the oldest continuously owned family farm winery in the U.S., opened in 1855 by Adam Puchta, who is my fifth great-grandpa.
And he was immigrant?
Immigrated from Germany. Mm-hmm. We have a very rich history in the winemaking scene, and everything was going really well until Prohibition, obviously. And
how did you guys get through Prohibition?
So everything just kind of turned over to just straight farming. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know everybody was farming already. They continued to farm and make it a business out of it. They decided to not reopen the winery. Probably it was a little bit hard for them. You know, they ripped all the vines out, all their production equipment, everything got destroyed. So that was pretty hard on them. So they decided to close it. And then in 1990, my grandpa and my dad, Tim and Randy, decided to reopen the winery. They all grew up on the property. Grandpa lived on the property growing up, and they decided to reopen it. And it's been a challenge for sure. But I was homeschooled for many years and got to grow up on the property and really engage with a lot of different things.
That so you grow your estate grapes on property?
We do. So currently in production, we have our Vignole, which we make with our dry Vignole, and then our estate Norton. And then we had planted 4.5 acres of Adal, and we have some Verona, and then we got two other varietals that we're planting in 2 more years. But then we work very closely with other growers and other wineries in the state.
In your marketing and sales, would it be primarily through your tasting room?
So we see about 30 to 40,000 people come through to do tastings a year. Oktoberfest, obviously, we're really big for this town. Self-distribute, we sell to over 300 stores in the state of Missouri. We do some direct to consumer, and we do have some wine club, which is pretty cool.
You probably put on different events.
We do a German dinner in our 1855 bistro, which was built in 1854. Some different MyFest events, Oktoberfest, we have food. We have a wine run, which is really cool. We've set up a 5K through the vineyards and stuff.
To learn more about your world,
follow us on social media, Adam Puchta Winery, adampuchtawinery.com, Parker Puchta, yeah.
Parker. Yep. Very, very cool. Thanks for sharing.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for being here.
Who do we have here?
So Mike Sloan, Herman Wursthaus.
Tell us about what you do and how long you've been doing it. This is a life shift for you, right?
I've been doing this part-time job for about 55 years. I'm hoping it turns into a full-time job. After working for somebody else for 45 years, I thought maybe I could do this to my wife, and I bought this building. It was vacant for 5 years, and prior to it being vacant for 5 years, it was an auto parts store. So we opened it up, got rid of all the spark plugs, fan belts, and gradually we now, you know, 10 years, 11 years later, we make 45 flavors of bratwurst, 12 flavors of bacon, 10 flavors of summer sausage, snack sticks, jerkies, hams, things of that sort. Indoor, outdoor seating, all you can eat breakfasts, and open at 5:30, 7 days a week. Except on weekends, we're open 8 to 8 on weekends.
And primary distribution is people coming in here?
Main source of distribution is the front door. If we don't capture that sidewalk activity, then we'll ship it to you. And then we also do some distribution to some chain stores.
And again, you're a real trendsetter in distribution of your sausage and whatnot through your vending machine.
So the vending machine was something that I seen early on in 2016 at a trade show in Germany. I looked at it, kicked the tires on it. By the time the year 2019 got around, I've been thinking about it for a couple of years, and this COVID thing was starting to come up, so I thought now's the time. So we bought it, and it arrived about 9 months later. Mm-hmm. And we put it up on the sidewalk out in front of the store. So, you know, it's no human contact, 24/7.
How much is in the machine? What varieties?
So the biggest varieties, and it was kind of a learning curve to figure out what people wanted. And what they want is the same thing that sells inside, bratwurst snack sticks. But one thing I did do, and I found this out, but just through trial and error, is I sell a lot of cake, chocolate cake, carrot cake out there in the vending machines. Because people at late night want a dessert. Mm-hmm. They're walking the street, they come out of the bars, or maybe their lady friends want a chocolate cake or carrot cake. I like going out there early in the mornings. Usually I film at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, early when there's nobody else out there.
So you do a lot of the heavy lifting still, huh?
I got a couple guys that are pretty big. They're like linebackers, just like Parker. I mean, those wine cases aren't light.
And we're sitting in the middle of a sit-down area in your retail space.
In our retail space, we have seating indoor, outdoor for about 140 people. I want to sell by the plate, by the pound, or by the pallet. I haven't sold by the plane load yet, but you know,
getting there.
But getting there. So yeah, if they like what's on their plate, most likely they're going to buy some to take home. You know, if they like our apple bacon or our best show bratwurst or caramelized pear, they're going to buy a couple packages.
The only thing you're missing are fan belts.
Those fan belts were on hangers, and I got about 10 buckets of fan belt hangers upstairs in the attic. I was doing my teardown. The only thing I kept was those fan belt hangers, because I thought, you know, if this sausage thing didn't work out,
there you go,
I could always go back and sell fan belts. It was Napa store. Yeah.
To learn more about your world,
HermanWurstHouse.com. My name is Mike Sloan, owner, Wurstmeister at the Herman Wurstmeister.
The best of the worst. I love it.
Best of the worst.
Mike, thanks so much. That's
thank you. Really thank you cool. for being here.
My pleasure.
Scott Drochnik, St. Charles County Economic Development Council.
Word picture, visualization.
We're on the western side of Metro St. Louis, so it's a suburban and rural community that's bounded by two rivers at the confluence.
So is it a happening county? Is it a lot of vitality now?
Well, I'm not very subjective on the question.
Right, yeah.
But St. Charles County's been the growth leader in Metro St. Louis since about the 1980s.
Oh, wow. How do you explain that?
Lots of land, and so as folks were growing, they were looking for homes and new roads, new schools, new homes that were cheaper than the other places, mm-hmm. drew a lot of folks out. And according to the last census, we're currently at about 5,000 a year moving in, so it's a good, healthy clip.
Is there a downtown core to the county, or...?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking. The downtown core is along our riverfront. It's in historic St. Charles, which is actually the second largest registered historic district in the entire United States. Everybody
wow.
thinks of over in Charleston, South Carolina. Well,
mm-hmm.
you'll love that. Come out to St. Charles County because you'll love the historic riverfront.
A little infill, visual word picture of what somebody would experience.
The historic riverfront, they actually still have the brick roadways, and a lot of the homes and the buildings date back 200 years or aroundabouts. It was such a nice, old-fashioned looking area. They actually filmed one of the Tom Sawyer movies there, pretending that it was Hannibal from, mm-hmm. you know, the mid-1800s. But you'll see stuff that's colonial, there's bed and breakfasts, and there's been a lot of IT companies moving in.
Wow.
Folks liking those big rooms, big windows, and coffee shops and things that are close by.
Interesting. When was the town formed?
So St. Charles County dates all the way back to when President Jefferson bought the Louisiana Purchase. And so this was our first state capital in Missouri.
On the western frontier.
We were. Go west, young man, young woman, whatever. That's where it all started out here.
Yeah.
But now we're the middle of the country. We used to be the west coast. Now we're the middle
exactly.
of the country.
Hard to believe, isn't it? So tell us a little bit more about why visitors, you know, why tourists would come to St. Charles.
Well, one of the neat areas, and that's where we're actually right now, is down here in wine country, Missouri wine country. And what folks don't know, lots of things have happened in this area over the decades, but this area in St. Charles County and in Missouri was one of the largest wine production areas prior to Prohibition.
Mind-blowing. I did not know.
We always think of California, but you know, it was Missouri.
Well, how about America's oldest AVA.
Exactly.
I had no clue. Tell us about that.
Exactly. St. Charles County was, as you said, certified as the oldest viticulture area in the U.S.
And I bet half people in Napa have no clue.
Well, they're going to find out pretty soon because we're becoming the Napa Valley of the Midwest.
You guys are really ramping up to the next level, not only wine production, grape growing, but marketing.
Well, this has always been just a lovely area that's out this way because you've got the Boone home and you've got the Katy Trail, which is
Daniel Boone.
Place? Exactly. Not birthplace, but death place, where he died, where he spent the latter year of his life. Yeah, the judgment tree and all of that stuff.
Wow.
But Katy Trail, which is how we've taken our Missouri KT Trail from St. Louis to Kansas City, more or less.
And backstory on why it's Katy. Because that was your railroad, right?
Right, from Missouri to Kansas and Tennessee, and so MKT, and that's how they ended up calling it as the state park.
The nickname was Katy.
Right, and it stuck.
And so that's a classic rails to trails, right?
It is. One of many across the U.S., and anytime you go out, you see lots of folks walking their dogs, taking a jog, riding their mountain bikes, anything that's non-motorized.
Mm-hmm.
So very pastoral, lots of vineyards, lots of agriculture and farms and forests and refreshed. Going back to the wine production of stuff, you know, stuff after Prohibition took a while to take off. It wasn't until about the 80s or 90s, a few little wineries. And then the Hoffman family, we appreciate all they've done. He grew up in the area, not too far away. They were here, as the story is told, for Christmas, I guess about 2 years ago, and said, honey, I like this area. We should start buying it. And so they did. $125 million later, all the wineries, all the vineyards, all the buildings, you know.
Yeah, I heard it was like $150 million.
Well, I won't be shocked if they end up with $200 million. But, so they're taking it to a new level.
And a little backstory on the Hoffmans. I mean, grew up with nothing.
Exactly. And now he's a billionaire on the Forbes list. And we appreciate the favored son coming back and blessing the area with huge investment. And they've bought up a lot of the old town in historic Augusta, and they've been buying that, turning it into a general store and a gas station and restaurants. Now we've got the river cruises that are going to be happening up and down the Missouri River to historic St. Charles down here. And
you know, what an amazing economic development for employment. Opportunities.
Massive material impact. Yeah. As they were coming in buying a lot of the companies, we appreciated the fact he didn't just come in, buy it, and then fire everybody. Mm-hmm. He said, we want you to stay. We're going to give you better benefits. We'll raise the pay. You're the subject matter expert. We want you to run it, yeah. And we just want to give you the tools to take it up to the next level. It's going to become a nationally known destination area for tourists. And so I remember coming down here some 20, 30 years ago when it was just a smaller area, maybe a bus or two, but now folks are holding their weddings down here, their graduations, their conferences, you know, it's a booming area.
And for local and regional travel, it makes sense because, I mean, I talked to one of the heads of state economic board and he's right an hour away.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So if folks have a meeting on the East Coast from the West Coast, stop here. It's not flyover country anymore, but lots of good things to enjoy.
How far to get from the little St. Charles waterfront district to downtown Metro World?
Depending on traffic, it's about a 20-25 minute drive.
Wow,
so it's not too far at all.
That's crazy.
10 minutes to the airport. So we like to talk about travel in terms of minutes rather than miles, because I lived in Chicago for a while, and if we said, oh, it's 10 miles away, oh my gosh, you know, pack a dinner. Yeah. But here we think about it in minutes, because you're there quickly.
To learn more about your world,
the EDC's webpage, which is edcscc.com, and we've got a lot of information about quality of life, growth in companies and opportunities in tourism and shopping and the whole bit.
I can hardly wait to get down to your waterfront. That sounds fascinating, especially the architectural history.
Yeah, you're going to love that. And lots of festivals happening there on a regular basis. I'm Scott Drochnick from the EDC St. Charles County.
The rural village of Augusta, Missouri. It's less than an hour's drive to St. Louis, but it's truly a world away. Jerry and David Hoffman grew up in Washington, Missouri, at a time when David's family didn't even have running water in their home. After graduating from college, Hoffman's initial foray as one of the world's foremost corporate headhunters catapulted his business ventures to include investing in financial services, hospitality, aviation, media and marketing, and more. A viral Hoffman focus is real estate ventures across America. The Hoffman family grew to become the biggest developer in Naples, Florida, with 42 commercial properties, including ownership of the Hertz Arena and the Everblades hockey team. 50 years later, the Hoffmans returned to their roots to reinvigorate the small town of Augusta, Missouri. It's just a stone's throw from their hometown. With an initial $150 million economic infusion, including renovations of more than 60 historic homes and commercial enterprises, along with ownership of 4 wineries and more than 1,250 vineyard acres. We met up with David and Jerry Hoffman at a Fruit of the Harvest dinner in Augusta. Come along and join the conversation to discover the rest of the amazing story of the Hoffman's passion and love of Augusta, and how they are in the midst of turning the area into a national wine destination, slated to rival Napa Valley.
David Hoffman.
And I'm Jerry Hoffman.
And where are we?
We're in Augusta, Missouri at Mount Pleasant Winery.
And you both grew up around here?
Yeah,
we did.
15 minutes away. Dated in high school.
So meant to be, huh?
Yeah. Meant to be. I was 15.
I was 14.
Tell us about your journey, your life in 60 seconds.
Yeah, well, you know, we were high school sweethearts,
right,
which was fun. Grew up in a small town, went off to the big city, and found ourselves, after building a company that's global with 9,000 employees, back to where we started.
Wow, that's crazy. What happened? I mean, you're just a regular working class guy, right?
Yeah.
I think we're all just regular folks.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, you get lucky in life. And
what started your journey? What did you first do that clicked?
when I was 25 years old.
Can I interject?
Yeah, sure. You actually, always do.
I always do. But I think it goes back a little further than that. I think you should take it back to when Dave grew up. I think he's been hungry. He's had a little fire in his belly from the time I met him.
So that was a motivator.
It was a motivator, yeah. And he's always been driven.
Yeah. I grew up without hot running water. I didn't have hot running water in my house.
Wow.
15 minutes from here until I was a sophomore in high school. Uh-huh.
But you guys do now.
We do now. Yeah. And I think those humble beginnings, you know, Jerry met me. She said, you know, you need to take a shower.
Oh,
I can't. I like to think I haven't forgotten where I've come from.
Well, what started your journey?
When I got out of college, I got a job in corporate America. From there, I decided to start my own company.
What was your vision then?
My vision was I thought I had a business that I could develop that was unique around the world, and that was in the executive search business. And
Headhunter?
Headhunter.
Uh-huh.
We did that, and that company grew to 65 offices worldwide.
Wow.
And about 14 years ago, my oldest son took over that business. Uh-huh. And then Jerry and I started branching out and buying real estate along with my youngest son. Then he got out of school. 4 years after that, built a billion-dollar real estate company for the family. And then we started buying all kinds of businesses. And
what attracts you to a business that you want to buy?
I think it's people and it's location. We're location-driven and we're people-driven. So we're in five distinct communities in America today. And then in terms of real estate holdings, and we have 240 locations in total around the world. We're in 27 different countries. But when we go in and put our footprint on real estate, mm-hmm. we become the biggest very quickly. We're now the largest owner of real estate in Augusta. We're the largest owner of real estate in Naples, Florida, Beaver Creek, Colorado, and
Winnetka, Illinois,
the North Shore of Chicago. And,
we're here in Augusta.
Yeah.
So tell us about that. You know, why?
Well, how fun is Augusta?
It's real fun. I don't want to leave.
I think we were drawn to the charm. You know, honestly, we were cooped up with COVID. I watched this story of Yellowstone, and we came down here to see Jerry's parents and our other relatives, and we always knew this area was beautiful, mm-hmm. and we thought as pretty as Napa. And I said, why can't we kind of do a Yellowstone deal here? And we saw that vision, started knocking on doors.
Well, it was also a little fortuitous because when we did the drive, the property at the corner of 94 and Jackson actually had a for sale sign on it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the first piece of property. And in a year and a half, we've got 51 properties
wow.
here. Now we're building three hotels and we have 1,250 acres and we employ 600 people in the area a year and a half.
There's a whole nother layer, and that has to do with viticulture. And
yeah.
wine and grape
yes.
growing. You want to make this the next Napa.
And
is that a conservative statement?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's bold, but
Napa's beautiful, and Napa has a lot going for
gorgeous.
It. But, you know, we were first, and Missouri.
Interject there, because I did not know. A lot of people do not know.
Yeah.
Tell us a story.
Well, you know, you heard about the Phloxera.
In France,
and how these Missouri, the two Missouri, one was a scientist and one was a vine grower, and they developed this pest-resistant rootstock. But one of these gentlemen also went out to Napa and started Napa Valley. He left Missouri and went there, so that's sort of how Napa Valley also got its start.
Oh, interesting.
So we've got a connection there as well.
Yeah, and we've had friends out. We're both involved with the wine festival, which is the largest wine festival.
Naples Winter Wine Festival.
Naples Winter Wine
uh-huh.
Festival. So we have friends in Napa and been to a lot of it, and they've been here, and they're a little surprised on what they find.
Mm-hmm. But you're just starting, right?
Yeah, we're just getting rolling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Looking forward, what's your vision? I mean, you do things fast, roll out.
Yeah.
Let's say 2 years from now, what do you see?
2 years from now, we'll have three hotels here, major hotels, and we'll have be selling 2 million bottles of wine worldwide. We'll have a downtown that's vibrant like other downtowns in America. That's already starting. You saw a little bit of that day, I hope, on Walnut Street.
Mm-hmm.
And we're opening a new business in Augusta every 90 days.
Wow.
And that's going to continue. So
you know what the magic is? So far, you've retained a Mayberry RFT mm-hmm. feeling. It's like a Hollywood movie set.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is. But the scary part is, how do you not lose that? You know, how do you?
Well, that's a real concern. And
yeah,
it is a concern of all of us, and we love the charm here. Nobody wants to change the charm.
Yeah, I don't think we will. That's mm-hmm. a great question. But if you look at how we do it, we're not developers, right. We're redevelopers.
Interesting.
And we've never torn down a building. We have 240 of them in the U.S. We renovate them. That's a lot more expensive to do, mm-hmm. but the end product is the end product.
But then on top of it, you have that patina of age on the building.
The history here is just, it's just incredible. Mm-hmm. It's profound.
And it goes way back. I mean, I was talking to somebody today. Well, when did this start? And they go like 1830 or
1840. Yeah.
Wow.
And over in Washington, where our family is from, I mean, we've got deep, deep roots there that go back to the early 1800s. Mm-hmm.
If you guys keep doing what you're doing, this really could be a game changer for the state of Missouri as a destination.
We think so. We hope so. I think that's been the thing that's been the most gratifying is how supportive the state of Missouri has been with these efforts. I've thrown out the first pitch three times at a St. Louis Cardinals game. The Bush family, who founded Anheuser-Busch, has reached out to us and been extremely supportive. Local governments have been extremely supportive. You know, you often don't get that when you come in and influence change. And
you here get the opposite a lot.
Yeah. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful journey and experience. Coming back to our home state, mm-hmm. where we grew up.
And not far from your home.
Just minutes away.
15 minutes. Same high school district as we both grew up. She went to Georgia, which is the Catholic high school, and I went to the public high school. Uh-huh. And we went to school with a lot of kids who grew up in Augusta. And so same school district. So we're in the same school district where we started.
Is this home for you, or are you more based in Florida, D&D?
You know,
back and forth.
We're back and forth, mm-hmm. but we spend a lot of time here now. And every day we get a little more connected here. So it's feeling more and more like we're home.
Right. The people here are great. The sense of community is just, it's just an all-American mm-hmm. area.
When I know that a key to your success is your perceptive ability with people, because without people, you have none.
Yeah, I agree with that. And
this is the
thank
business
you
started, Dave. I mean, it was a people-based business mm-hmm. and a good news business. He was finding jobs for people. It was awesome.
That company that I started in 1989, last year, was named one of the 400 best places to work by Inc. magazine in America.
Wow.
It was named by Forbes as one of the top five businesses of its kind to mm-hmm. operate businesses anywhere in the world.
So again, that harkens back to the human dimension.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because without it, it's just a bunch of bricks and mortar.
Yeah, that should be attributed to my son. I mean, he's just done a fabulous job. And this really is a family affair. And we have great employees, and we have 9,000 of them now across the world. And
you probably know everyone's name, don't you?
I would like to think so. I know a lot of them. You know.
I could keep you guys all night, but I thank you so much.
Well, thank you for your interest and your enthusiasm. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, fascination. Love it.
Thanks. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks again.
My name is Jim Waddell, and I'm a resident of Hannibal, Missouri, on the banks of the Mississippi in Marion County, Missouri, about 100 miles or so north of St. Louis. I'm not a native of this town, but I am a native of the area.
What brought you to Hannibal?
It was an act of God, pretty much, Tom. I was in the Branson market. And I had an uncle that came up from Quitman, Mississippi, and he looked around and he said, you know, Jim, Branson's never going to amount to anything. Since I had always been in tourism, the only market for tourism in Hannibal in 1995 was Mark Twain.
Right.
So that's how I got involved.
And so you became a reincarnation of Mark Twain, right, as far as impersonating? And you do performances?
I do a performance at the Mark Twain Cave April through October, 5 days a week.
And is it formal presentation? Or?
It's a formal presentation. Uh-huh. It's a staged presentation. I do Twain's material verbatim. That way I don't have to depend on my own wit or lack thereof.
Little taste, a little teaser. Go Mark Twain for us for a moment.
I've been trying to get into jail all of my life, but I've always had the worst luck. Whenever I do anything, there's never any witnesses. And my reputation for veracity is so poor, they won't accept my testimony without corroborative evidence.
There you go. Do you feel like you know Mark Twain in a way, like you're just one degree off from being able to sit out front and have a conversation with him and have that comfort level of a friend?
He captured every emotion that he experienced and put it down on paper. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons he is so popular worldwide, Tom, is because he is the penultimate human being. It's not gender-based, it's not partisan-based, it's not nationally based. It is just being a human being, and he put that down on paper. And I think that's why everybody relates to him. So mm-hmm. I think everybody that reads Mark Twain knows him. You know, he said that the difference between the right word and the almost right word was the difference between lightning and the lightning bug. And that really explains his knowledge of lexicography. And when you look at his career, from when he was just a boy, everything led him up to becoming the lion of American literature that he turned into. I mean, his formal education stopped when he was 11. His father passed away. So he goes to work as a typesetter. And at that time, the newspapers were the formal form of entertainment. I mean, books were rare in a little frontier village like Hannibal. So the newspapers published serialized novels. So he was reading the best literature every day and learning the language. I think he was like 15 maybe when he got his first story published in the Boston Bee. It was called Dandy Frightening a Squatter. And experimenting, of course, humor was prevalent in all the newspaper articles of the day, so he got that kind of exposure. Mm-hmm. His mother was a brilliant, eloquent person. She spoke very simply, but put some biting satire in some of her things. Mm-hmm. He tried to learn how to swim out here in Bear Creek, and he almost drowned. And his mother was not perturbed. And he asked her why she was so calm about it. She said, well, a boy that is born to be hanged has nothing to fear from the water.
He said something like, yeah, I almost drowned there every summer.
Yeah. Well, I know at least three times that, yeah, Jim Wolfe pulled him out. Yeah.
So it is double powerful to come to Hannibal and walk down Main Street and walk by his childhood home. I mean, how rare that it's all very much unchanged.
You know, we have a levee here by the town. The Mississippi River flooded drastically in 1993, and the levee had just been placed a year prior to that. Up until that point in time, nobody spent a cent in these buildings because they flooded twice a year.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a rundown district. But since then, since they put that levee in, that's one of the reasons we look like we are prospering right now, is because we have all this new renovation, relatively new, a generation-old renovation in our historic district.
But again, it's very much intact architectural history here.
Yeah. I don't know if you've ever heard, there's a economic forecaster named John Nesbitt who wrote a book called Megatrends 2000. And he said there's an economic phenomena that recurs all over the world. It happened in the Left Bank in Paris. It happened in the French Quarter in New Orleans, Haight-Ashbury, Greenwich Village. He said, what happens is artists are chronically unemployable, and so they seek out the lowest rent district. So they'll move into a place like Hannibal's historic district when it's still run down.
Mm-hmm.
And once they get a large enough mass of artists, the area starts to take on their personality.
Mm-hmm.
That draws in the salons and the boutiques and those industries that want to be associated with the arts, which drives the real estate up, drives the artists out. The whole process starts again someplace else.
And that's happening here?
Yeah, you can see kind of a gentrification here.
I almost hate to talk about this because you don't want to spoil paradise by creating a land rush. But in the scheme of things, I mean, compared to the West Coast or East Coast, real estate is mind-blowingly inexpensive for a beautiful home.
And that is probably a thing that will not last much longer.
It's a miracle that it's under the radar right now. How far to St. Louis?
About 100 miles. We have a little regional airport over in Quincy, Illinois, and you can fly to St. Louis or Chicago from there.
Is that Cape Air on that
That's
one?
Cape Air flight, yeah.
Yeah, that's how we flew in here.
I love it. You know, little prop planes, it's like Sky King.
Awesome.
Yeah, it is.
I'd do
fun.
It again. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a great experience.
Yeah. A little bit more about your world here, about Hannibal and Mark Twain.
Well, we have a brand new riverfront here, and it's wonderful to be in a community where you have all the advantages of being in a small town, and yet you're not deprived of any of the amenities that people living in metropolitan areas have.
Somebody wanted to learn more about your world.
Well, I perform at the Mark Twain Cave April through October, Wednesday through Sunday, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It's about an hour-long production. The website for that is marktwaincave.com. I do a presentation on the inspirations for Tom Sawyer at the Mark Twain Museum. And my name is Jim Waddell.
Jim, thank you so much for the great morning in Mark Twain's hometown of Hannibal, Missouri.
Tom, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. When I first visited the state of Missouri, I kept hearing people talk with reverence about one of their favorite sons, outdoorsman extraordinaire Johnny Morris. Incredibly, Morris's multi-billion dollar empire all started with a tiny 8-foot square bait and tackle stand in his parents' Springfield, Missouri liquor store. Today, Morris's empire includes more than 170 Bass Pro Shops across America and Canada, a world-class Wonders of Wildlife National Museum and Aquarium, and so much more. Come along and join me for the sampler of Johnny Morris's incredible outdoor empire. We'll start our exploration with Misty Mitchell, Director of Conservation Programs for the Johnny Morris Foundation. She offers an overview of special things to do and see.
So the Johnny Morris Foundation attraction includes three properties. Dogwood Canyon down in Lampy, Missouri. You can take the tram, you can go see the bison and the elk and the longhorn. You can actually do a lot of waterfalls, and there's a chapel and a nature center. An amazing property to connect you back to the outdoors and engage outside. And then just north of that, you can head to Top of the Rock. And at Top of the Rock, you've got the Lost Canyon Cave Trail. You're going to take a golf cart, and you're going to go down 2.5 miles of trails, beautiful waterfalls, lots of outdoor overlooking Table Rock Lake. And then you're going to head over to Ancient Ozarks Natural History Museum, 35,000 square feet of artifacts galore, amazing artifacts from Civil War, Native American, just amazing things to see there. And the last location where we are today, we're at the Johnny Morris National Museum and Aquarium in Springfield, Missouri, 1.5 million gallons of water through this aquarium. And you can see all across the world with our wildlife galleries, the dioramas from Africa, the polar regions, and head into the swamp and the ocean. We have penguin encounters, and we also have an out-to-sea dive that you could do. So a lot of amazing things in the conservation attractions. Key is to get people outdoors and engage them to conservation.
That's so awesome. Silver Dollar City Amusement Park, situated in the heart of the Ozarks, offers incredible thrill rides such as their legendary 7 roller coasters. But it's the staff that makes the destination world class. Many of the employees have been there for decades, with the treasured few working there for more than a half century. Live shows and concerts and more than 100 resident craftsmen. 18 restaurants and 60 unique shops. And it all started with a historic cave, one of Missouri's deepest. And of course, cave tours are a highlight, and the roots of the theme park and its 1880s theme.
Brad Thomas, president of Silver Dollar City, right here in Branson, Missouri.
Tell us about your personal connection and how you wound up here. You can harken back to elementary school when you first fell in love. What today still resonates with your heartstrings?
People of this place intrigued me as a kid, and they intrigue me today. I remember in the candy factory as a kid, one of the workers said something like she had never been out of Stone County. Silver Dollar City is situated in Stone County, which is in the very extreme part of southern Missouri, borders Arkansas. And I walked away from her thinking, was that true? She'd never been out of this county? And you know what? Those stories and those comments make this place so real, and the personalities and the hospitality.
One of the first things you mentioned Silver Dollar City is, oh my God, the roller coaster.
People will travel from Europe to visit southern Missouri because of these amazing rides and our festivals from the spring all the way through Christmas. But I have to tell you that those things may get people to visit here, but the thing that keeps people coming back time and time and time again is typically our people. To some of the old timers, I'm still a newbie. And you know that you're in a culture that's immersed in longevity when people can be here for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years.
Over your shoulder, steam engine. Tell us about that.
We have a steam train. That train been running the tracks at Silver Dollar City since 1962.
Well, let's go back in time to how this place started. That's a great story.
It's a fascinating story. We've been family owned since the day that this park opened.
How did it start?
It started with Marvel Cave, which is a national landmark. It's been on the National Registry since 1972. The cave is below the town square, which is where we're sitting right now. And that cave, the Statue of Liberty can actually stand up in that cave. It's fascinating. And there was a town on top of that cave. And that town is really the roots of what now is Silver Dollar City. And then May 1st, 1960, Silver Dollar City opens and the rest is history. Brad Thomas, I'm the president of Silver Dollar City right here in Branson, Missouri.
Awesome. Brad, thank you for sharing.
Thank you.
When the steamboat Arabia sank near Kansas City, Kansas on September 5, 1856, she carried 200 tons of cargo. Back in 2011, we visited with Bob Hawley and his wife at Arabia Steamboat Museum, located inside the River Market in downtown Kansas City, Missouri. In 1988, Hawley and his partners located the steamship lost for 132 years. And they dug it up in a farmer's field. The incredible array of artifacts, including clothing, china, carpentry, tools, guns, dishes, and children's toys, as well as the world's oldest pickles, are preserved and displayed at the Arabia Steamboat Museum, located in the historic city market. The river had shifted over the years, and the Arabia was encapsulated in mud that served as an ideal anaerobic environment, perfectly preserving the thousands of artifacts. Hawley passed away in 2019, and presently there's talk of relocating the museum to St. Charles, Missouri. But for now, the Steamship Arabia Museum remains open to the public inside the city market. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a visit with Bob Hawley and his wife, Florence, back in 2011.
Harland Maynard Hawley.
You go by Harland?
No, I go by Bob.
Bob, here we are in Kansas City, Missouri, and we're at a phenomenal museum of the steamship Arabia. Tell us about how this happened.
Well, you were in the refrigeration business, sent David on a service call, and he wound up with a person that was into old steamboats and some 150 boats that had sunk in between St. Louis and Sioux City, Iowa, and he was told that about a third of those were under farm ground and because the river had moved, and that sounded exciting to us. And you know, maybe a couple guys with shovels could go out and find an old steamboat. And that's kind of the mentality back then. But anyway, we got to studying about steamboats, and it was more fun and more fun, and we began to get more serious about it. In a 2.5 year period, we found 6 of the 10 boats that we'd researched, and we were hell-bent for digging one up, and we had 6 lined up to dig, and we were going to dig and sell and dig and sell and pick the boat closest to home, and that was the Arabia. We were finding so many good things that we decided to not have a sale, and we were going to have a museum. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much the short version of what we found.
I understand that your collection of artifacts is the largest, greatest collection of pre-Civil War artifacts in the United States of America. Tell us about that, how extensive it is and what it includes.
Well, we found right at 4,000 boots and shoes. We have on display now about 1,500 to 1,600. The boat was supposed to have 200 barrels of Kentucky's best bourbon. That was the exciting thing for many, many people that looked for the Arabia. The man that owned the field, Norman Sorter, he really didn't want us to dig the boat. He kind of thought we were just wasting our money. Ultimately, he gave permission and he sent us off with the phrase, "You're never going to see this boat because there's too much water in the ground." And he was almost right. And the most expensive part was getting rid of the water. And we had 20, 30 horsepower pumps going 24 hours a day to keep the water out of the hole.
What I find just staggering is the pristine condition of some of the foodstuffs. Tell us what's over here.
Well, we have a lot of pickles, and
one of your friends ate some of the pickles, right?
Jerry ate one of the pickles, and
he was okay.
Yeah, he's okay, and he's bragging now that since he ate that pickle, he hasn't aged any. And but we had fruit, we had wine, champagne cider.
And these literally look like they're 5 years old.
Yeah, we have oysters in the can, and they. They're not good shape. So these are assorted fruits and berries and things like that. And this is gin in the little bottles that with a little, they got brand new corks on them. But
and then you have perfumes and cosmetics.
Cosmetics and perfumes and all kinds of Dr. Hostetter's stomach bitters, which was mostly alcohol. Mm-hmm. It is a remarkable collection that that is still quote unquote edible.
Behind you there are a few hundred boots and shoes.
Those are boots and
shoes. And they truly look showroom new, don't they?
Well, we have to process the boots and shoes. The cotton threads have dissolved away, so we have to re-sew the boots and have to soak them in polyethylene glycol and
preserving, stabilizing.
Mm-hmm, right.
Over here behind you, I saw there was a wool shirt that looks, again, like it was made 2 years ago, over to the left.
Yeah. These are new technology on the frontier. That case there, those were new things. Some of them lasted, some of them didn't. Mm-hmm.
The paddle wheel, that's from the ship?
No, it's a copy. The pitman arm is from the boat, and the engine and the support.
Behind you, there's a tin of sardines. There's the meat looking like it's almost edible. That's scary phenomenal.
That is scary. Nobody ate the meat, though.
Yeah, really. And that's 1856?
Yeah, 1856.
Bob, for further information about the museum in Kansas City, you have a website.
Yeah, 1856.com. That's the year the boat sank.
Bob Hawley, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I knew when my husband went out and bought a crane one day, he came home and said, well, I knew we really were going to go. I didn't take him serious to begin with, but you know, at the end of the dig, that picture, you see him watching the barge float away. It had that crane on it. We took it, floated it back here to Kansas City and sold it for almost what we had in it. And this is one of the engines. So it had two engines on it when it went down. Able to get one off before it went completely under because they could use that steam engine. We took that all apart, cleaned it up, and if we had the steam, it would still go. And
the museum is non-profit, private, no government funding, no subsidies.
Yeah, you know, it's a gamble to dig a boat. Would you want to invest your money in digging another steamboat? There might not be anything on it.
Well, I think it was you or your husband. You were talking earlier to me about the day that one of the tractors broke down, and it was that was $10,000 for one repair.
It gets pretty expensive when you have big equipment moving around.
And your full name again?
I'm Florence Hawley.
And you go by Flo?
Go by Flo, yeah.
Flo, thank you so much for sharing.
Glad to have you guys.
Well, thank you again.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.